I'm alcoholic. My name's Kim. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to talk at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank Mike for asking me to come out here and do that today. I feel like I should be talking in the round. I'm hoping that as I'm talking, the podium's going to turn slowly so that everybody can get a piece of me, you know. I probably want to start this out by acknowledging my friend Mark H., who passed away recently. He had about 6.5 years of sobriety, and he was sick, and God took him when he was supposed to, and I think I want to dedicate this talk to him for what that's worth. I'm sure he's listening, sitting up there in a big meeting in the sky. And I feel pretty good because my wife is sitting over here over my shoulder, so I know I'm going to have to be honest about something. And you know, I'm one of those alcoholics who really, I say I only lie when it's convenient anyway. So most of the stuff you hear from me will be the truth today. You know, everything I tell you is going to be my opinion. I don't quote anything from the big book unless I have it in front of me. Oh. Well, you know, let's kick this off with... I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was about 16 years old, and I didn't get it the first time, so I'm going to tell you about everything that happened before that for a few minutes. And what happened before that was, you know, I come from a nice middle-class family, and my dad worked hard, and my mom stayed home, and she did the best she could to raise us two kids, and then they split up. I grew up out in California in L.A. County in the San Fernando Valley. And when I was growing up out there, you know, I pretty much remember just going to a lot of different schools and the chaos that was going on at that time in that part of my world. A lot of stuff happened to me. I was born with some physical problems, and it took about, oh, I don't know, the first 12 or 13 years of my life, the first 11 or 12 years of my life to straighten them out, literally. I was born club-footed and pigeon-toed, and, you know, I have a member of my family who's in Alcoholics Anonymous today, and when people in our family sober up, we start hearing stuff about history and what's happened, and so my father shares stories with me from time to time, and he told me once that when I was born, the doctors said, "Mr. Robinson, we don't know what's going on, but we're going to do the best we can to fix it." And they really didn't. They didn't have any idea what was going on. Both my feet were turned in almost 90 degrees, and I was walking on the balls of my feet because my Achilles tendons were too short. And so my life for the next, 10 or 11 years was nothing but surgeries and being in and out of hospitals and so on and so forth. And I got to tell you right now that I think there's probably a connection between that and my alcoholism at some point, because back then I think they were probably giving me morphine for pain, and that's what was reported to me. And so who knows, maybe that kicked things off when I was 5 or 6 years old. You never know. But anyway, my parents decided that when I was about 9 years old that they wanted to split up, and that was all my fault, and I proved it. And all the normal stuff that happens to us started happening. I started decelerating in school, I guess you might call it. I really wasn't causing any trouble. I just wasn't doing anything in class, you know. And part of my experience with my lower education was that they made me do stuff like learn how to play the cello. I had to carry this big cello around with me for a while, and then they tried the piano accordion. And then after that was over, I said I was tired of all that, and I didn't do that anymore. And like I said, my parents split up, and that started my course of education, going through different schools and doing geographics through different schools for a long time, between the time I was 9 and probably the time I was, well, almost graduated. I never graduated. I'm a GED graduate. I think I went to 5 or 6 different elementary schools, probably 5 different junior highs and 4 different high schools or 5 different high schools. And I still couldn't figure out why I couldn't graduate, you know. So anyway, I didn't do that. And right about that time, I'm 13 years old, and I'd done a geographic with my father and moved to the East Coast. And I'll tell you what, Florida's probably a nice place to visit, but I don't ever want to have to live there again. I had a lot of trouble. Most of it was probably related to my surname. You know, I'm just grateful I'm not a boy named Sue, because that caused me a lot of problems. And when I came back from Florida, I discovered that my younger sibling, who had come back before me, and some of the childhood friends that I had grown up with were smoking pot and drinking beer. And I was probably kind of jealous because they got a head start, you know. So I took my first drink. I took my first drink, probably smoked my first joint when I was almost 13 years old. And I was off and running. You know, I talk about this a lot with some of the people that I work with. And, you know, really the bottom line is that the second I did that, something happened to me. And I decided that I was going to keep doing it. And I decided that I was going to do as much of that drinking thing and those outside issues as I possibly could. And so that was what I tried to do for the next 4 or 5 years. And I told you I started coming to meetings when I was 16 years old. I continued to get loaded periodically and drink. And pardon me. And I continued to do that while I was going to meetings. And I'd put together 2 or 3 months, and then I'd go back out and relapse again or get loaded. I don't like the word relapse. I don't really like the word slip. I really believe that every time I did that, I only had one purpose in mind, and that was to get drunk and loaded. There was no, I'm only going to have one beer. I didn't know how to have one beer. I didn't know how to drink one-fifth. I didn't know how to smoke one joint. I didn't know how to snort one line. I didn't know how to take one pill. So that was pretty much, I mean, I've just wrapped up my using career right there. I was one of those people who would use as much as he could, as often as he could, whenever it was available, because I knew that above everything else, in spite of what was going on in my life, I needed to do something to change the way I felt so I wouldn't have to deal with what was going on. You know, I was thinking about the gentleman that spoke on Thursday night when I was at the specific group meeting, and he was talking a lot about stuff that happened to him when he was a kid, and I try not to do that because I brought mine out once and then I killed him. You know, I want to leave that part of my life behind. It's resolved and it's over. And my life's focus today really is about what I'm doing in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think. But anyway, I proceeded to go through all these schools, and I was living with a family member who was definitely a heavy drinker at the time, that's for sure. I'm talking about my father. He's a member of this program, too. He's got 16 and a half years of sobriety now, and I watched him, and I really didn't pay attention to him, and I was just doing my own thing. And I got to hit a bottom in sobriety in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my bottom was pretty simple. You know, my bottom was that I went out that one last time and I wasn't intending on slipping. You know, one of my sponsors in California, I was joking with Donna the other night, one of my sponsors in California, when somebody gets 6 months, he gives them half a cake and a slipper, you know. And I wasn't intending on slipping. I had every intention of staying sober that night. And instead, what happened was I think the phenomenon took over and my thinking took over, and I ended up going out with two other people. And we got drunk. And we smoked a little bit outside issues. And the very next thing that happened to me was I wasn't welcome in the house that I was supposed to be staying in that night. And then I found myself coming to in a park in Camarillo, California the next morning, Las Posas Park in Camarillo, California, if anybody's familiar with that part of the state of California. There's a psych hospital out there that's not a state psych hospital anymore. It's a college campus now. So that was what happened to me when I finally hit bottom, only there's more. The more of it is really simple. The more of it is that when I came to that morning, I had to find a way to get home. And since I didn't have anything, no driver's license, no car, no bicycle, no bus pass, I had to hitchhike 20 miles back to my house. And at that time, I was living in a motorhome with my father in a little town called Agoura, California. We happened to live behind a bar, the local bar in that town. And I think I remember coming home and laying down on my fold-out couch bed that I slept in every night. And I really think, and I have to tell you that this is the absolute truth, that I believe that that was the minute when I knew I was completely finished. Right? I think that every alcoholic, they come to a place in their drinking career where only a couple of things are going to happen. You're either going to be absolutely done or absolutely dead. You know? And I wasn't thinking about being dead. But I knew that what I was doing wasn't working anymore, and I'm going to tell you how I knew that. I think that the very first time that I drank or didn't eat dope, I really, really, really liked what it did for me. And I think the last time that I drank and did dope, my thought process had changed again, and I was no longer happy the way I was living. And it didn't make any difference by that time how much dope I used, how much alcohol I drank, how many pills I took. I don't think that that was going to fix it anymore. And so I got home that morning. And, you know, the first step for me really is an absolute conscious decision that I'm finished, that I can't do that anymore, that I have lost the privilege and the right, you know. And I didn't have the right to do that stuff in the beginning because of my age, but I lost the privilege and the right to drink and drug at my leisure when I wanted to, as much as I could. I lost that right, you know. There was nothing in the world at that time that was going to be able to restore my ability to drink and use like a regular person. I don't want to say normal because I don't think there is. You know, normal to me is somebody who can drink and drug the way I did and doesn't suffer the kind of consequences that I suffered. But I really believe that I lost the right to do that. And when that happened, I think I was finally able to recognize the stuff that's talked about in this book, the insanity. Right? I did a lot of crazy stuff when I was drinking and drugging. But if I look back at the year that I spent coming in and out, really what was going on was my thinking would tell me that I could go do this one last time and it would be okay. Nothing would change, right? And really, if I'm honest, and I try to be, nothing really did change because the circumstances in my life remained the same the entire time I was drinking and drugging. They remained the same. I think that when you're a young person like that, really your parents probably own everything you think you own, you know. So really I didn't have anything. And when I got sober, when I finally stopped this whole deal, everything that I thought I had in my possession fit in a closet that was about, oh, I don't know, maybe 24 inches deep by 36 inches tall by 24 inches wide. And I had my whole life in that little box in that motorhome I was living in with my father when I was shortly after my 17th birthday. That was in October of 1981. And my sobriety date's October 3rd, 1981. And I knew that beyond a shadow of a doubt, I couldn't do this anymore. And really, it's kind of a shame because I want to be a successful drunk and dope fiend and be able to do all that stuff and have fun and go to the clubs and do all the stuff that I used to do. but I can't do that anymore. You know. And reality of the situation is when I stopped, when I finally made the decision that I was going to stop, I wasn't going to those places. I wasn't hanging out at the Starwood in Hollywood, if anybody remembers that club. I didn't have the ability to get there. And by then, you know, really the truth is I didn't have any friends. I probably had some enemies, but none of them wanted to be around me either. So I didn't have any friends. I didn't have any resources. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a car. My parents were smart. They said, you can get your driver's license when you're 18. And I think they reflected back to the time when I was about 14 years old and I stole my mom's poop brown Pinto and proceeded to run it through an apartment building wall into somebody's apartment. You know, and it was a minor error on my part. I put my foot on the gas by accident and I thought I was in park. You know. So, I mean, I could probably tell you that that's the convincing moment that told them I didn't need to have my driver's license until I was responsible enough and old enough to get it myself. And I broke my arm when I was about 14 years old. And there was this place, as a matter of fact, I was talking with somebody about this yesterday who come from the same part of the valley that I come from. And we were reminiscing just a little bit, because you don't want to do that too much with people. We were reminiscing just a little bit about places that we used to hang out and stuff like that. So I'm up at this place where everybody used to, all the stoners, man. All the stoners. We used to cut school and go to this place up in Laurel Canyon. Laurel Canyon's kind of cool. Laurel Canyon's rustic and old, and it's like two lanes going each way between the valley and Hollywood. And a lot of rock stars and movie stars and stuff like that on property up there. And there was a bunch of fire roads up there in the Hollywood Hills, the North Hollywood Hills, actually. That's real classy. And we used to go up there and party, and there was a big swing up there off the side of one of these hills on these fire roads. And I was not myself, needless to say. And I'm swinging on the swing, and I go out and come back and go out, and I'm probably 30 feet off the ground, and I'm so loaded I think I'm done, and I let go, you know. It ruined my high, I can tell you that much, because when I hit the ground, I heard the really loud thud that my body made. You know, if you've ever heard a body hit the ground from any distance, it makes a lot of noise, and usually if somebody's standing nearby, they can feel the reverberation. I'm sure somebody did. Anyway, I broke my arm. I ruined my high, which was probably the worst part. You know, the only thing I really had to look forward to at that point was I'm going to go to the hospital. They're probably going to give me some more dope, you know. And then, you know, they didn't give me really good dope afterwards. Anyway, they gave me some codeine, and most people don't like that stuff, you know. Anyway, I broke my arm. That was just one of the calamitous things that happened to me when I was drinking. But if I put all this stuff together, if I put everything together, my parents doing their thing, me doing my thing, my brother doing his thing. You know, we had pet rabbits. They were doing their thing, I'm sure, when I was young. Everything that happened to me led up to me ending up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous through another program. I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous through a program that was based on the 12 steps, that was designed for young people like me. And when I walked into those rooms, I was faced with, I don't know, I guess you could call it my home group at that time, probably 150 other young people like myself who were all trying to achieve the same goal. Well, they were trying to get sober. I wasn't sure why I was there. But eventually I figured out that that's why I was there after I hit that bottom finally. That bottom, by the way, I want you to know that it's possible for you to go out with other people in this 12-step program and participate in a relapse. You know, I don't know if anybody's ever done that, but my last drunk was with two other people in that program. We were all sober a long enough period of time to know better. And I think our fatal mistake was that we started talking about the way it used to be like. You know, and this isn't about, I'm going to come and talk today at Frank Bunker Park and tell you about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. We were talking about what it used to be like, and it started to get attractive. And we decided to go take some action. You know, it's kind of like a third step in reverse, I guess. We went and took some action, and then I found myself coming to in that park the next morning. If I remember, I was wet and cold and had to present with a situation where I had to get home. And on that very last drunk, I paid some consequences, too. I don't know if anybody else here paid any consequences on their last drunk, but I did. And most of the consequences that I paid throughout my short drinking and drug career were emotional in nature, because people would look down on me and go, what are you doing? You know, I had a lot of people around me who condoned my behavior too, family members and other people, but what am I doing? So I proceeded to start going to those meetings. What does it say in the big book, without quoting it, all the fervor of a drowning man grasping for a life preserver? And I went to those meetings, and I went to those meetings, and I went to those meetings, and the stuff that they started telling me started sinking in, like, I'm powerless, you know. And when I drink and do dope, my life becomes unmanageable. And when I think about drinking and doing dope, my life becomes unmanageable. And when I think about doing stuff like that, it means I'm insane. When I think about doing stuff like that, it means I have no consciousness of some kind of a power greater than myself. And they told me I had to get a God. And my story is probably not dissimilar to anybody else's. I had the same basic, Christian belief system that I'd grown up in. But, you know, I abandoned all that stuff like a lot of us do, I think. I had no use for God when I was drinking and drugging. I had no use for organized religion or spirituality or Sunday school or any of that other stuff. Hi, Terry. I didn't have any use for any of that stuff. And when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me that if I wanted to get this thing, no human power was going to be able to relieve my alcoholism. So what am I left with? Because I know that every other human being in my life at that point had failed me, including my family. So I'm powerless over alcohol, and no human power can relieve me of my alcoholism. That doesn't leave very many choices, right? My choices are really simple. You know, I can do what it talks about in step two, right? Either die an alcoholic death or live a spiritual life, pick up those tools and start living. And, I got to be honest with you, I wasn't sure which one was going to be more attractive. But I knew that I didn't want what I had anymore. I knew that if I kept doing what I was doing, I was probably going to die. And I have some proof of that. It's spiritual proof, but it's proof nevertheless, I think. Had about 2 years of sobriety, and I was in a sober household. I'm spending the night, we're having a party or whatever, and I have a dream about doing something that I'd never done before, and it absolutely convinced me beyond a shadow of a doubt that if I'd continued to drink and drug for a couple more years, I wouldn't have seen my 20th birthday, you know? And I had the funny part about that is that I think a few years before that, I had the opportunity to go try some injectable outside issues, and I didn't do that. You know, I didn't do that. So I think that dream probably saved my life. Probably saved my life, you know. And I haven't had very many of those dreams in the last 25 years. But the ones that I have had have done nothing but confirm my suspicions about myself, right? That I definitely have the disease of alcoholism. And I want to tell you that I don't know how I got it. I don't care. I probably could have gotten it from my dad. I might have gotten it from that morphine that I was getting when I was a little kid. I could have gotten it from being born. I don't know. I could have contracted it hanging out with all them kids I was hanging out with who were smoking dope and drinking. I could have gotten it from, I don't know, the grass growing in the ground. Who knows? It doesn't make any difference to me. The bottom line is that today, I can tell you I know exactly who and what I am. You know? And today what I choose to be is I choose to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous because I feel like I fit in here. I never felt like I fit in anywhere. You know, I never felt like I was a part of. You know, I would be hanging around with 200 or 300 kids, go to some kind of a social event, and I was absolutely alone most of the time. You know, and I really feel like, you know, a lot of them kids were probably just my friend because they took pity on me or something. So when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I realized that people probably cared a little bit about me, it changed the whole story. So I proceed to start going to meetings and I do all the things that they tell you to do. I get a sponsor. Because I know that I'm powerless and I need someone to help me run my life. And my first sponsor gets arrested on cocaine charges and goes to jail. I think it took me about a year, you know, and some of the literature that I see and hear in Alcoholics Anonymous say, you know, take your time, but not too long. And so I finally did find somebody, but really, I think I was probably basically sponsorless in Alcoholics Anonymous for about 6 years, you know, and I did the steps because I know that in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not a requirement to have a sponsor. And I found I was smart enough to find somebody to help me take the steps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and so on. And I don't know, and I can't tell you about any relief I might have gotten at that time. I just knew that I didn't have any secrets anymore. And that helped me set myself free a little bit more. And I know one thing for sure that happened. I lost the obsession to drink. You know, I lost the obsession to drink and do dope. It got taken away from me somehow. So I don't have that problem anymore. Now I have a problem learning how to live and be in relationships and have intimacy and do all that other stuff. And work. I had to go to work. So I go through a lot of life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to do a lot of stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm one of those people in Alcoholics Anonymous who had some sick relationships, and I think I finally got it right. You know, I've been married to my wife, Donna, for almost 7 years, and we haven't killed each other yet. That's a good sign. And I'm not getting kicked out of the house. That's even better. And this is the part where I tell you that we have a nice little life, and it's nice to be here with a lot of my friends because a lot of the people here have been to my house, and we enjoy having people in our home. And I don't have to worry about people coming to my home and seeing that I've hit another bottom. Right? I don't know if you've ever been to a drunk's house who's still drinking, but you can see they're hitting the bottom. Right? You can't see that at my house. Well, maybe a little bit, I don't know, but you can't see that at my house. And today I have a God in my life that I choose to believe wants for me the same thing that my current sponsor says he wants for him, that God wants me to stay sober and help other drunks to the best of my ability. And I try to do that as often as I possibly can, sometimes to a fault. And I did all the fourth and fifth step stuff. You know, I did another one about 2-3 years ago, and I did one about, I don't know, I'm not one of them guys who goes in for, you know, the annual house cleaning. I think that when there's something wrong with me, I know it, and today I can do a 10th step. I did 4 and 5. I know my defects of character and my shortcomings. They're real simple. They're out in front of me all the time because I still try to control stuff. And I'm still self-centered. You know, I'm an alcoholic. It's real simple. Those are my shortcomings. And I can very easily allow those shortcomings to get in my way or get in the way of other people. And sometimes it is incredibly difficult for me to not do that. But somehow I managed to get that done. I don't know how that happens, you know. And my amends list, thank God, my amends list is really small from when I was drinking and drugging. It got larger the longer I stayed sober. You know, if you're wondering how that happens, I'm going to tell you. You get credit cards, you start spending money, you know, you buy cars, and, you know, and I struggled because I didn't get the luxury of having anybody at school or in my household tell me how to manage a checkbook. You don't have much of a checkbook to manage when you're working for $5.65 an hour anyway, but, you know, I think that was how much I was making on my first job. But since then, 8 and 9 have come true for me. I've been able to clean up a lot of the wreckage that I created in my past, make room so I can create some more, you know, and not as quickly, I hope. And today I live in 10, 11, and 12. It's pretty simple. I do try to do the right thing. I show up at work every day. I bring that money home with me at the end of the week when I get paid. We take care of our bills. And we do the very best we can to take care of another alcoholic if it's necessary, if it's called for. And I really believe that as long as I keep doing that, I won't ever have to worry about anything ever again as long as I live and stay sober, you know. And I'm one of those people who I really believe, you know, that I'm going to probably, if I stay alive long enough, I might set a record in Alcoholics Anonymous for years sober. When I was at the World Convention last year, I got to go to the World Convention last year in Toronto, Canada. There was a guy that stood up in one of the main meetings in the front of the arena. There was a seating section of about 200 or 300 people, all long-timers. This guy stood up. He had 63 years. I'm thinking I can do that if I keep breathing, you know. My story today is pretty simple. You know, I get to show up when I'm asked to show up. You know, and my sponsor today is he don't pull no punches. He tells me the way it is, you know. And I had a sponsor like that. I've had a couple of sponsors like that. The one thing I can tell you about the people that have sponsored me in Alcoholics Anonymous since I've been sober is that none of them have ever lied to me. They've never told me anything that will hurt me. And I try to do that with the guys that I sponsor who are sitting right behind me because they want to make sure I'm going to keep it honest. Like I said, I only lie when it's convenient. It's not today. And I think that I'm just about running out of time. It's about 1:45. And so I think I just want to talk about one more thing and if I could remember what Clancy said, I could probably baffle you with something until I figure out what it is. I think that my gratitude in Alcoholics Anonymous, I try to show that every day. I understand gratitude and love are action words today. If I tell somebody I love them and I'm grateful for them, then I need to do something to show that, and I try to do that every day. And I think that when I lay my head down at night on the pillow, I don't sleep very much anyway, but when I do sleep, I know that I go to sleep almost immediately, and I can tell you that wasn't my experience for the first 10 years of my sobriety. My head would race all night long sometimes, and today I go to bed and I put my head down on that pillow and I say my prayers and I go right out, you know, kind of like passing out, only I'm not drunk. And I wake up in the morning, and I don't wake up in the morning with all the guilt that the drunken person wakes up with. You know, I wake up with a clear conscience and I can see my way to doing the next right thing that day, like getting up, taking a shower, going to work, you know, put some clothes on so I look presentable. And I really don't do that for work. I do that out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous because everything I learned growing up in this program. And I owe a debt of gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous that I will never be able to repay. So the plan from here on out is very simple, that I'm going to remain sober one day at a time until whenever it is that God decides to take me away from here. And while I'm here, I'm going to do the very best I can to be an example of Alcoholics Anonymous at whatever level. And I want to thank Mike and these other folks for asking me to come and talk. And have a nice day.